You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and radiocafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. In just a moment, we're going to be talking with Santa Fe Institute economists about what a fair and functional economic system would look like. But first, just a couple of words from our sponsors. The Radio Cafe is brought to you by the City of Santa Fe Water Conservation. As you know, if you're living here in Santa Fe, we had a warm winter and we didn't get enough snow. The snow brings the water we need, and as a result, New Mexico's drought is currently among the worst in the United States. As the summer heats up, water restrictions in Santa Fe will be coming into effect, and we're being called upon to renew our conservation efforts and learn more about what we can do to value our water. Visit facebook.com/savewatersantafe to take the City of Santa Fe's new drought online quiz and learn not just about the current condition of the drought, but also how to contribute to long-term efforts to maintain a healthy, green, and water-wise Santa Fe. This program is brought to you by Total Wine and More. With locations in Santa Fe and Albuquerque, each store has about 8,000 different wines from all over the world, and thousands of beers, including both major brands and microbrews and imported beers. And they have more than 3,000 different kinds of spirits, all at the lowest prices you'll find, and with a trained, knowledgeable staff. They're on the web at totalwine.com, and you can order for in-store pickup. And if you use my promo code, you can save even more. Use code 6979 at the store or online and receive $10 off on your next $50 purchase. That's code 6979. Thanks again to Total Wine and More for sponsoring the Radio Cafe. I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Sam Bowles. He's an economist and a research professor at the Santa Fe Institute. And Wendy Carlin, who's a professor of economics at University College London, they're giving a community lecture called After Trump and Brexit, A New Economics, Forget Red and Blue. That's on Tuesday, July 17th at 7:30 at the Lenzic Performing Arts Center. Now, both of you have a long history in the real world as well as in academia. Sam, you've been an advisor to the likes of Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and Nelson Mandela. Wendy, you're an advisor to the Office of Budget Responsibility for the British government. You've come up with a new curriculum for teaching economics, which we'll talk about a little later. First of all, welcome.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
Yeah, it's a pleasure.
Great to have you. So we live in an economic system that we don't necessarily really understand. We've got lots of names for it. Capitalism is the first one that comes to mind. Also, neoliberal economics, which is a term that's kind of hard to understand because we wonder, like, what is liberal about it? What is neo? What is new about it? What does the term actually mean? What are the basics of that economic model?
Well, it is kind of an odd term, neoliberalism. What it really means, and has come to mean, is a faith that the market economy, that is unregulated markets, the pursuit of profits itself, can work out pretty well for most people in society. It has nothing to do with the liberalism of the past, which was really a theory of tolerance and a really morality that we should respect each other and advance democracy. But the neoliberal idea really started out in the 70s, 80s, and 90s in both Wendy's country and mine, UK and US, as a very aggressive move against any kind of government regulation of markets and also a pushback on social programs.
So the idea that markets shouldn't be regulated, what does that mean? What kind of regulation are they pushing back against?
Well, it depends on which market it is, but for example, it means that in the labor market, you should just let chips fall where they may. Trade unions get in the way. Laws protecting workers, for example, from capricious firing and so on, just are sand in the wheels of the capitalist economy. They make things go slower. They force firms to essentially not make the adjustments that they need to make. The idea is basically to turn the economy back to a highly individualistic system in which we have individual profit makers and then individual workers, and they bargain with each other, obviously not from a position of equality. So that means deregulating the labor market. Deregulating a financial market means something else. Wendy knows a lot more about that.
So the idea was to move away from a system in which there was a lot of regulation over the interest rates that were set by banks, for example, and regulation over the activities and cross-border activities that banks could engage in. So there was a big stripping away of regulation in capital markets and across the financial sector more broadly. And that was one of the factors that lay behind the excesses in the financial system that led up to the financial crisis. And we can think of the financial crisis of 2008-2009 as being a kind of once-in-a-lifetime event that's really shaken economics, shaken politics, and is one of the big reasons behind why we're observing the big fractures in politics across the world.
There is the clarification that I think it's important to make, which is when you talk about neoliberal economics and free market economics, there's kind of an argument that it's best for everybody, but the question of what's best for the worker and what's best for the owner of the company are two different things. And when we talk about the kind of regulations that you're talking about, it seems like minimum wage, even though the minimum wage is absurdly low right now, is still better than no minimum wage for the workers. Is it worse or better for the people who profit from those companies? How do you think about that? How should we think about that?
Well, if we look at the minimum wage itself, first, the minimum wage was brought in to protect people with almost no bargaining power at all, so that they might have a chance, through hard work, of making a decent living. Now, the value of the minimum wage fell drastically over the past 30 or 40 years. A few places, like Santa Fe, has really led the charge in getting it back up a little bit. But still, imagine trying to live on the minimum wage, even if you did manage to work a full time during the year. It's still really not enough. What's really remarkable is what Santa Fe has found out and what's been found out through economic research is that quite substantial increases in the minimum wage have had very little impact on either the number of jobs out there, but also had very little impact on the stock market values of the firms that were affected. So it's basically the people who were putting out the cries that, of course, this would be the end of small businesses and so on, have just been proven wrong. So I think that's really a dead issue. And to move on a little bit, I think we should say neoliberalism is also dead. It's a kind of policy framework which is still supported by some people in the political realm. But I think almost everybody realizes, after the financial crisis of 2008, as Wendy said, it isn't working. It's not working for the ordinary people in the country, and it's not even working for the businesses. The kinds of financial instability, the roller coaster economy that we've had, just isn't doing the job. So while it still has its proponents, because some people think that it actually does serve the interests of the very wealthy, and there are many of them, and they also have a lot of people who are speaking on their behalf, I don't think it's taken seriously as a policy program anymore. And that's one of the reasons why we're here today, because we have to find something that works. And obviously, neoliberalism didn't work. And we don't think that a lot of the things that are being proposed will work either. So we've got to think anew about a new economy.
Just to stay with neoliberalism for a moment, I think one of the things that's really important to talk about is what you just alluded to, which is that if you have an economy that is in a kind of volatile boom-bust cycle, that's why regulation came to be in the first place, whether it was interest rate regulation or other things. And so it's hard for me to understand why people would be against regulating their own industries when the result is stability.
Well, I think that you could say that that's what the results were of the immediate post-war period. So that's when we got used to government intervention to stabilize the business cycle. That was a period of growth, a period of falling inequality. But this helps, I think, to understand where neoliberalism came from, because that came to an end in the 1970s. With the emergence of rising inflation, of increasing conflict in the economy. It was a time in which, if you like, workers were on the ascendant, profits were squeezed. So that was a crisis in its own right. And it's out of that crisis came the return to, if you like, to laissez-faire and the idea that we needed deregulation to make the economy work better. So I think it really helps to have this historical perspective to see the emergence of regulation after the Great Depression, then the very different crisis of inflation in the 70s and 80s, and then out of that came neoliberalism and the turn towards deregulation.
Now, one thing that I also need your help understanding is it seems like we don't really have deregulation in the first place. I mean, we subsidize oil companies, but not solar companies. Just one of gazillions of examples. Isn't that a kind of regulation?
Yeah, so there's a real mishmash of protections in different parts of the economy, and that's certainly true. And it's probably fair to say that the target of deregulation in the neoliberal view were both the labour market and the financial market. So many of the other protections were left in place.
So I know we want to get to the new way of seeing, but I think it's still important to look at the old way of seeing and some of the weird contradictions in it. For example, the term special interests. So the idea that basically the kinds of movements like the environmental movement or the labor movement or minimum wage movements are special interests, but coal companies are also special interests. Those things aren't parallel. I mean, if you have a company that's making a lot of money but ruining a forest, to call the people who are trying to save that forest for a lot of different reasons, including the ecosystem services that it provides and so on, those shouldn't be thought of even with the same terminology, special interests, should they?
You couldn't be more right. If you want to think about what's really about neoliberalism, it's not that they came up with brand new arguments about how the unregulated market, so-called laissez-faire, was a good idea. Those ideas had been around for a long, long time, and they'd been severely damaged by the Great Depression, which taught us that they were mostly untrue. But so what the neoliberals came up with is not any argument for actually the markets unregulated being ideal, because they kind of had to concede they didn't work perfectly. But what they came up with was a brilliant idea, which is, okay, maybe markets aren't perfect, but you know what's worse? Government or any kind of organization in society which is beyond the individual. So it wasn't the idea that the market was great or perfect. It was that the government is worse. And not only the government is worse, trade unions are worse, environmental groups are worse, any group of people who come together to try to organize to affect the government.
Except corporations, who are groups of people who come together to try to affect the government.
Well, that is something which they set aside. But now think about how radical this is. If you understand how democracy works, it works because of people coming together. They have some purpose. For example, they're concerned about the environment, or they're a trade union, they're concerned about working conditions. They come together and they try to advocate for their position in the democratic marketplace of ideas and in the public sphere. That's how a democracy thrives and works. What they did, what the neoliberals did, is they took this idea from economics, which is that we're all completely selfish people, and then they said, okay, what that means is whenever people get together, it's just equivalent to a monopoly. It's just a group of people trying to strong-arm somebody else for their own advantage. And in just a couple of strokes of the pen, they wiped off the table what makes democracy alive and what makes it work. So that's really neo. And Wendy and I think that's one of the things we have to claim back. That is, the economy cannot work well unless we understand that people in the economy often act in very generous ways. They follow their ethical reason, whether businessmen, workers, consumers, and so on. We're actually a lot more moral as a people than economists will let you believe.
What are some examples of that?
Well, when we see people engaging, for example, in trying to protect the environment, they're not getting anything out of that. They're spending hours, in some cases, thousands of hours, just advocating for example, to clean up an incinerator or to protect a river and so on. We see it around us all the time. And it's also true among business people who often are very willing to spend time on things which they care about and things that other people should care about. People say, oh, well, you know, you're exaggerating. But what's happened in economics in recent years is really a fantastic advance in science, because We've always said, well, we're going to assume that people are selfish because it makes it simpler to reason that way. We never really believed it. Adam Smith didn't believe it. No great economist has ever believed it. But about 30 or 20 years ago, economists began actually doing experiments with people, putting a significant sum of money on the table and saying, okay, now you can divide it up in some way. And these are very carefully designed experiments in which people are anonymous. And what's remarkable is they're incredibly just when they do that.
So let's just try it out. Suppose that we gave you $100 and we said that with that $100, you can make me an offer of a split of the $100. So you can decide exactly how much you're going to offer me of the $100. And the deal is that if I accept your offer, then I get what you've offered me and you get to keep the rest. So how much would you offer me?
If you're really asking me that question seriously,
yeah,
I would ask you what you need.
No, just so you can think about that. I'll let you
think
about that.
I would say, how much money do you make every year versus how much do I make? And then we would come to an agreement. That's what I would do personally.
Okay, suppose that you're not allowed to engage in any discussion, but you can engage in as much introspection as you like. So just think about the situation I've placed you in and make me an offer. What kind of an offer would you make me?
So I would say, I'm looking at you, I'm looking at what you're wearing. You look like me, 50-50.
Okay, that's very interesting. So you offer a 50-50 split. That's quite common as an outcome of one of these experiments. But just to clarify what this tells us about how so-called textbook economics would suggest people behave, they would suggest that you would offer me maybe a dollar. And why would that be a sensible thing to do? Well, you would think to yourself, well, if you offer me a dollar, then a dollar's a dollar I wouldn't have otherwise, so I should be very happy to accept that. And you would keep the $99. So why didn't you do that? Why didn't you just offer me a dollar?
Because you look like me and I figure we have about the same needs. But if you were homeless and I could tell you were homeless, I'd give you the whole thing.
Yeah, well that's...
And if you were wearing, I don't know what, like super, super fancy, like $800 shoes, I'd offer you a dollar. I don't know.
So I think why it's interesting to conduct these kinds of experiments, and they've been conducted among groups of people all around the world, also among groups of students. And the remarkable thing is that the results are very similar to the ones that we found in our little exercise here.
People tend to be egalitarian.
Yes. And so there's something there where you're thinking about me. You have concerns about me, concerns of fairness, for example. And that's something that sits outside the standard way economists think of what people are like. And it's that view of people that was wholeheartedly part of the resurgence of the ideas in the neoliberal paradigm. So it was that kind of writ large, not just for individual actions, but for the actions of all kinds of groups in society.
Now, when you say economists tend to think that way, you guys don't think that way. So who are these economists? Are you talking specifically neoliberal economics? Or are you talking about everything that's been taught in school in college for the last 50 years?
Yeah, it's everything that's been taught in college for the last 50 years. And it lines up. You can line up the textbook economics with, if you like, the neoliberal view. They're peas in a pod with this particular view about people. The point that Sam was making is that contemporary research in economics has gone way beyond that. So we now have a huge body of research, very strong foundations to take the view that people are very different from that. And that really drives us in a different direction when we're thinking about how the economy can be made to work better.
One of the things that I have been so struck by when interviewing anthropologists is that hunter-gatherer cultures, for example, are profoundly egalitarian, and they were together for about a quarter of a million years as the foundation of human existence and human psychology, and the sort of dawn of agriculture and everything since then, and capitalism, which is fairly short-lived, is much less egalitarian. But that foundation is kind of deep within us, isn't it?
Absolutely. What you said is exactly the case. The most long-lived way of organizing society, the most long-lived set of institutions, is exactly how they did things. They shared stuff, they shared information, they insured each other, and they survived. there were competing forms of society which didn't make it. Now, of course, hunter-gatherer society is no model for the present, but it is something which we have both culturally inherited, but also, I think, genetically inherited. That is, we are a generous species. We're a species which are able to cooperate. And if we have to think of our economic future in a sustainable environment, we cannot overlook that. It's a wonderful thing about us. And for economists to simply set aside the better half of humanity, in the sense the better side of ourselves, really deprives us of a great resource. When we think of policies for the environment, for example, we can't be going to people and say, look, it's really in your interest to protect this particular water source or something, because it probably isn't really in their interest. It's in the interest of somebody 100 years from now or a future generation, not their kids or grandkids and so on. You have to hope that people are going to think morally, and people do. That's what the experiments and games that people have done have shown. People are very willing to pay money for justice, and they do it. They do it anonymously. So I think it's time that economists stopped advising policymakers that you have to go to people and say, this is in your interest, this is why you should support it, and instead define what we ought to be doing as a country, as a society. And I think people will appeal to that. Not entirely, not everyone. Of course, we have selfish concerns, and we ought to have them. But they're not the only way we have to behave. And we have to develop those, we have to let them flourish, and use them as a resource for public policy.
I think there's another piece to that, which is, what do we mean by self-interest? Because, I mean, if we get the Rio Grande flowing properly, or the Santa Fe River flowing properly, or the Colorado River, which is overallocated, that is certainly in all of our self-interest, and it's also in the interest of the whole, and each one of ourselves is part of that greater whole. And so maybe we're not talking about our annual income self-interest, but we're talking about our society self-interest as water drinkers, or as people who eat food that's produced in the fields that are watered by those rivers.
Well, that's exactly the view of us as a social animal, that is, seeing us as living in society, thinking of ourselves as being part of a community. And when you say self-interest, what you're really saying is, I feel like I'm part of this place, and I have an interest in this place doing well. That's how most people think, at least part of the time. Maybe not when they're shopping, maybe not when they're competing with somebody, but when they engage in politics, they're capable of thinking in the way that you just said. And that has to be an important part of how we will have a hope for the future, which is both more fair and more sustainable.
So let's talk about that now. What would a new economic paradigm look like? How would it take the best of what we've got now, get rid of the worst of what we've got now, and maybe do something new?
Well, we have a lot to go on. We have a new view of humanity, which is we're capable of cooperating for the good. We have a different view of the economy, which is that actually markets don't work very well most of the time. We're now confronting serious dangers from global climate change. But it's not only environmental. We have also very serious problems in the labor market. Anybody can see that the labor market fails to provide adequate work at living wages for people, not to mention discrimination against people. One market after the other, you see, they don't work well. The credit market doesn't work well because vast numbers of Americans don't have access to more than a little credit, or perhaps payday credit, or credit at exorbitant rates on their credit cards. Now think about that for a minute. What that means is that most Americans can't possibly be part of the game of innovating. If you can't borrow money, you can't innovate. You can't innovate even to learn a new skill, or maybe even to move to a region in the country where your employment prospects are better. So the credit market is essentially excluding vast numbers of people, because if you don't have money, you can't borrow. That simple fact means that the inequalities of our society and our faith in unregulated markets means that our society is less creative, less innovative than it could be if it simply addressed the fact that markets are a wonderful servant, but they're a horrible master. And we have to learn that lesson, make use of markets for the good, but not let them run our lives and run our society.
I've heard this metaphor, maybe it was from you, I can't remember. Capitalism is like fire. You keep it in the fireplace and poke it properly and it warms your house, but otherwise it burns your house down. Was that from you?
No.
Okay, anyway. But what about markets that do work? I think of, for example, local brew pubs. One of them comes up, another one comes up. They compete with each other. They have a healthy competition. People decide whether they want the local Belgian brew or something else. And you have a kind of local thriving market economy based on consumer choice in a kind of textbook way.
That's absolutely part of a vision of the new economy, with the elements just of the kind that you're suggesting. The question to ask is, how have those small enterprises been able to establish themselves? What we need is to bring together a mechanism that allows people with new ideas, whether it's for a different variety of IPA or whatever it is that's your particular taste, to have a go. And to bring that together, so the ability of people to join the market and then to utilize the capacity of the market to penalize the failures. So that's the great characteristic of the market. The market provides a way of getting rid of losers, and that's one of the big lessons of the failure of the planned economies. They had no way of getting rid of hopeless enterprises, and that was a complete way of deadening innovation and renewal and enterprise. So the market can play and should be playing a very vibrant role in the new economy.
And this is one of the reasons why we have to go beyond ideology, and one of the reasons why the subtitle of our talk on Tuesday is Forget Red and Blue. And the reason why we say that is that there are a lot of people who consider themselves left of center who think that the market is somehow the enemy. And of course, you have to understand why people would feel that, because the market has punished people who really need help, and people think there has to be a better alternative and so on. Let me give you an analogy drawn from biology. We think a key aspect of a good economy is that it's innovative, and that it grows, and it creates, and it makes the best possible use of our huge capacity for learning. Now, what's really required? Think about Darwin and think about the Darwinian system. There are two really important parts of it. One is variability. You have to have something that creates differences. That's the creativity part of it, which in the modern Darwinian system comes through genetic mutation. So you have all kinds of new things being, quote, tried in biology. But then, of course, most of them are not really very good ideas. Most mutations are lethal. And in fact, probably most economic ideas or most people's thoughts about a kind of business they'd like to start, they may be a little bit like mutations. So we need something like natural selection. The selection process, which comes when there's a drought or some difficult physical environment for an animal, means that the new designs that have come along that don't work very well, they don't make it. But that combination of creativity and also tough love when it comes to whether you're going to survive, that's what we have to have in the economy, and that's why markets are so essential.
So where do they go wrong?
Markets go wrong the diagnosis is actually remarkably simple. If you and I are trading, say, shirts or buying stuff, markets do a pretty good job. If we're exchanging something in which someone else is affected, so for example, suppose I'm producing automobiles, and I produce automobiles that pollute a lot and have effects on the environment down the road. And you're buying the car, and I make money by selling it to you. But sorry, there are other people involved in this exchange, and they're not really included in my calculation as the producer of the car. They're not included in yours either as the buyer of the car. They're the downroad people who are going to suffer the effects of global climate change or traffic congestion and so on. So the key problem in markets is this. If what goes on between the buyer and seller is all that goes on, and if all of that is actually in a contract so that I deliver something to you and you pay for it, and if you don't get what I told you you were going to get, you can just enforce the contract in court. In that case, markets work pretty well. The cases you gave, the small businesses and so on, they conform to that pretty much. But a lot of our markets are not at all like that. There's a lot going on that's not between you and me. It's between you and me and other generations and our neighbors and so on. That's where they fail. That's what economists call external effects. It's external to you and me. In those cases, economists say that markets fail. Now, the question is, when markets fail, what's the solution? There are all kinds of solutions. Sometimes governments can do better than markets. and sometimes they can't. It's a practical question whether or not the fix is worse than the disease. But in things like, for example, environmental effects, we know there are very effective policies that work to curb some of those market failures. And they, of course, ought to be adopted.
Let's talk specifically about that. I mean, we've got problems that are so huge and so urgent on a time scale that the challenge of fixing them should really be on the forefront of everybody's mind, and they're not, namely global climate change, plastic pollution in the oceans, fertilizer pollutions at the mouths of rivers creating gigantic dead zones, unsustainable agriculture, I mean, basic real food and water and air kind of stuff. What do you do about that as an economist, as somebody working in policy to mitigate that in a way that is really effective?
Well, it may seem strange to say, but fixing the environment is intellectually not as difficult a problem as you'd think. We have a pretty good idea of what the problem is, and we have a pretty good idea of policies that will affect, for example, the amount of emissions. The problem of the environment is a political problem, which is there are people benefiting from pollution and there are people being harmed by it, including future generations. So it's not really rocket science in economics that if you simply put a heavy tax on polluting activities, you would vastly reduce their extent. We already know that by comparing across countries. So perhaps surprisingly to your listeners, it isn't really rocket science to figure out what to do about the environment. The problem is to figure out how to make sure that the people who will be harmed by polluting activities and the other things you mentioned will have a place at the table.
One example of this is in relation to solar panels. So subsidies were given in many countries for feed-in tariffs from installing solar panels. This created great incentives for innovation through ordinary market processes in developing cheaper solar panels. And that's had a marked effect on the proportion of energy generated through renewables. So that's a combination of intervention, relatively straightforward intervention by government in providing subsidies, that triggering innovation, lots of people competing to produce better, cheaper solar panels, those being installed, and then that having a clear effect on the energy balance. So I think that's a good example that things can be done. So we shouldn't be entirely pessimistic about this. There are effective policies. We know how to evaluate their effectiveness. And if we can get them implemented, and that's why a cross-country perspective helps, because we can see these things happening in some countries and even in the United States, in some states, much more rapidly than others. And then it's a question of putting on the pressure at the political level to get them done.
The free market ideology has become a kind of article of faith, and the defenders of the faith really are true believers. And if you so much as utter the word taxation, they have a fit, and they don't seem to be open to any other kinds of ideas. And this is evident in our media system, especially, but not only, the right-wing media system. So how do you shift the conversation?
Well, we're trying to shift the conversation by pointing out that the economic arguments that favored the idea of so-called free markets or unregulated markets, that economics is of the past. It's not what's being taught in graduate school to PhD students anymore.
What is being taught?
What's being taught in graduate schools in economics is that it's very much the standard case that markets work imperfectly, not perfectly. It's very much the case that the model that economists had in the past of so-called perfect competition, in which there are many, many buyers and sellers, there are no large players and so on, that's treated as some kind of a toy model that maybe illustrates some principle, but it isn't really the economy we're talking about. So I think that the first thing that we have to understand is that what is taken as economics by broadcasters, probably because they learned it in Ec 10, I'm sure half the members of the House of Representatives have taken at least one intro course, and in that course they probably worked that markets work perfectly because they're perfectly competitive. Well, we don't think that's going to be what they'll be learning in the future, because that's not what good economists who are doing research, being published, being successful, that's not what they think anymore. That's not what we know. I mean, we've come to reject two things. We've come to reject the idea that human beings are universally self-interested in the selfish sense. That's one thing we've rejected. We're much more capable of acting generously and cooperatively. And the other thing is, markets are an essential part of our society, but they don't work in any ideal way. There is something missing if all you have is markets and self-interested people. And we've seen that lesson over and over again. We didn't have to have the crisis of 2008. We already had the Great Depression.
One of the things that both of you talk about and think about is the question of monopolies. Do economies naturally tend toward monopolies? What's wrong with them? What do you do about it? What are today's monopolies? I mean, we think of sort of the old days of the auto industry and so on.
So there are many different kinds of monopolies, just as you've suggested. Many of them, the old-fashioned monopolies, arose from characteristics of the production process, and that allowed firms to take advantage of falling costs as they increased their production, and they could charge a price in excess of their costs, and that's a measure of the degree of monopoly. Measures to increase competition have worked successfully in some industries. Measures, for example, to open up the economy. So one aspect of globalization has been to increase the extent of competition, pressing down on firms that had monopoly positions domestically. But when we think about monopoly today, in that sense, the answer in a way was to increase competition to break up large firms.
So instead of having one automaker and you basically had to pay whatever price they set, there would be multiple automakers and you had better choice and they had to compete with each other on price.
That's right, exactly. And you can see immediately how availability of cars coming from abroad was a source of competition. But when we think of monopoly now, and there's a kind of acronym for this, they're sometimes called the FANGs, so Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, Google, Spotify, then we have to think quite differently about the kind of harm that is caused to people as a consequence of the degree of power that these companies have, and compare it with your auto case, with a firm setting a very high price and therefore restricting the number of cars that could be bought. So when we think of modern monopolies, then we need to think quite differently about whether this question of breaking them up is the right approach to the problem, or whether the influence that they're having, what's viewed at times as the harmful influence that they're having, is coming through different channels. So in the case of Facebook, people are much more concerned about the question of the access of those companies to our data, and they're supplying that data to advertisers.
And swinging elections. And
yes, exactly. So that's a very different kind of harm being imposed on the economy than the one that comes from a large automobile or steel company. And for that reason, the remedies that we might think of also take a different character. And I think this is an area that we're just kind of embarking on, trying to get a grip on, because it's clear that the simple solution of just splitting these things up is not an obvious way of dealing with the consequences that their domination of parts of the market is having on our lives.
If there were 7 Facebooks, they might all sell our information to these various parties.
Absolutely.
So that doesn't help. What would help?
Well, I think that one of the things we have to do is think about antitrust policy. The antitrust policy, which is the policy of breaking up large monopolies, or at least controlling them and not allowing them to form, the basic policies originated in the late 19th century, where we had these very large monopolies. And it was a kind of, I mean, this was antitrust, had things like the large oil companies, car companies, and so on in mind. And as Wendy said, what these companies did is they raised prices. So antitrust policy in America says, well, you don't have a problem unless these people are charging high prices. It's not a monopoly, because we know that's what monopolies do. Modern monopoly, I mean, if you think about Uber, Netflix, you know, Airbnb, and so on, they're not charging high prices. It's fantastic. They're charging actually pretty low prices. And so they're not on the radar screen of the antitrust because they don't have a high price problem. But as we know, they are a problem, and we have to find some ways of regulating both the working conditions of people who work there, the effects on our privacy, and so on. But the old antitrust, which is either break them up or you pay attention to them if they're charging high prices and not otherwise, that's antiquated. That's something that came from the last century or even before that. And these new monopolies are going to require other policies, but the basic idea is no longer that they should be broken up. They have to be regulated in some way.
How is Netflix a monopoly? They're competing with Amazon and Hulu and all these other companies that are doing kind of the same thing.
They have a very large market share. I mean, for example, if you think of them competing, I mean, this is nothing like the model that economists have in which you have thousands of people competing, producing, you know, groceries and so on.
So what is their market share? I mean, it seems like they are just one of a whole bunch of people who are both producing new films and distributing them.
So in some of these cases, there might not be a cause for concern. And one of the interesting things in some of these industries is the rapidity at which the situation changes. So the announcement of the television awards said that for the first time, HBO wasn't in the top tier after 17 years of dominating it. So there is a sense that there's innovation, there's pressure. Some of these players are jostling for position. We know that, for example, MySpace got completely washed out by Facebook. So this is an area where we're learning. We should be very alert and be thinking hard about the type of harm. You know, what is the harm? Is there a harm that's being...
Yeah, I'm having trouble understanding the harm of Netflix.
Yeah, so you like having access to the streaming services. And if the prices are being kept down by the availability of access to films through other media, then that wouldn't be a concern.
But why are you putting this on the list?
It's on the list because it's the N in fangs.
Yeah, so... So this is
that's not a good reason, Sam.
No, we didn't invent the word fang, but
yeah, no, I think that
yeah, otherwise it'd be...
there's a lot that we don't yet know about these different players, and Netflix would appear to be one of the lesser of those exerting any kind of monopoly power that would be conceived of as imposing a serious harm.
Yeah, I mean, besides the fact that we probably spend way too much time as a society watching television, I mean, that proliferation of streaming services and then the production companies that have arisen from them have led to some of the best actual production that we've seen in television in a long time. Anyway, moving along from that, let's talk about regulation, because I think part of the problem with regulation is that it can sometimes, depending on the regulation, lead to too much bureaucracy. There are good regulations, there are bad regulations. I talked once to a business person who was working in some industry, and they had some just really poorly thought out regulations in place. So she worked on a task force to replace them, and they came up with new ones, but they forgot to get rid of the old ones. And so then people had two sets of regulations to work with. They were going nuts. And there is a real problem of bureaucracy and regulation when it's not done right, which, according to a lot of people, is often. How do you do proper regulation? How do you re-regulate bad rules and put in better ones?
Well, it depends in which sphere of the economy we're talking. There are many regulations in the environmental area that have done a fantastic job, like getting lead out of gasoline. I mean, people said so, that obviously important thing to do, and it was done. Or the very big success in cleaning up rivers over the period from the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and so on. So people forget about the tremendous successes that have been made, and which were urgently needed. Now, of course, there are some stupid regulations, and moreover, these are exaggerated by people whose profits are being reduced by the regulations themselves. We, of course, have a biased system of reporting because the business people involved, of course, would like to get rid of almost all the regulations. So they love to pick on the ones that are particularly stupid. But there are a lot of stupid ones. When it comes to the question of what we call modern monopoly, well, that's a really hard problem because you don't really want to be regulating these modern monopolies. They're doing a fantastic job in lots of ways. And
you mean like Netflix?
Well, for example, Uber. I mean, I don't love the business model of Uber, but I think Amazon, Uber, and so on are doing a tremendous service to the public. The fact that they have the amount of power that they have is a problem. So what's the nature of the problem? Well, we want to make sure that though they are dominant, that they can't keep good ideas from coming in. The really important thing is not to break them up, not to regulate them, but to make sure that if somebody else could do a better job of, say, delivery or of providing the services that Amazon does, they'll get a chance. Well, you can't do that by competition. It's very hard to compete with these big people because of their huge advantages. So what's a possible way you could do this? Well, I think an alternative to regulation is to make buyouts, that is corporate takeovers, easier. Because what that means is somebody who has a better idea for how you would run something like Uber will be able to buy it and make more money on Uber than the people currently running the place. And therefore, the owners would be happy to have the new guys come in and do it. So this is just a way of saying, look, the basic problem is making sure we get new ideas into play. And that doesn't have to be done through regulation in this case. It can be done through changes in corporate governance that make it harder for the status quo to hold on if there's a better idea out there. Not who can then sneak in and compete on the edges, which you can't do. You're going to lose. But actually go in and buy the thing itself.
Does that not lead to more monopoly?
We're going to be stuck with monopoly in these areas where you have very small costs to actually providing the service, but very major costs to getting established. We cannot turn something like Uber or Amazon into a bunch of mom-and-pop stores or lemonade stands and so on. Forget it. These are very large organizations, and they should be very large organizations. We benefit from them being large. So the old sort of nostalgic idea that monopolies are bad and we have to break them up, it was true if it was, you know, a major petroleum or chemical company that was jacking up prices. But modern monopoly is a different animal. And we have to recognize the fact that it's large is good. We don't want to break them up. We want to make sure they can't keep good ideas out.
You've been talking quite a bit about how people are generous and people are cooperative, but we still have this massive, crazy wealth inequality in this country, and we've got CEOs making absurd amounts of money compared to the lowest paid person in their company. They're absolutely dead set against people making even a halfway decent wage. Then when they get tax cuts, instead of making more jobs, they invest in overseas investments. Nobody ever sees that money again in this country, certainly not the workers. That's the opposite of generosity. That's the opposite of cooperation. What do you do about that?
Well, I think that the increase in wealth inequality and increase in income inequality in the country is a real moral disaster for the country. And most people think so, too. Most people think that it's unacceptable, the amount of inequality that we have. So why does it persist? Inequality persists in part in America because economists, and not only conservative ones, but economists have taught people generation after generation that inequality is something you have to kind of put up with because it greases the wheels. It's the kind of thing that makes a capitalist system run better. It means that people are going to work hard. It means that people are going to take chances and so on. So the idea that inequality was really a good thing for the economy and it made it grow and made it do well, that was part of the ideology of economics, and it became part of the popular ideology. And of course, wealthy people spread the word because it was music to their ears.
Wasn't that also a kind of inequality that wasn't as extreme as the kind we have now? I mean, I don't think anybody thinks that every single person in the United States should get paid the same amount of money.
There have been times in the history of the U.S. before we were a democracy, that is before everybody had the right to vote, in which inequalities were of the current level. It has never occurred under U.S. democracy that it's been to this extent. But the idea that inequality was kind of a good thing, or at least something we had to put up with for economic progress, is an idea that dies hard, though it has been disproved in economics over and over again in the past two decades. If you simply look and see what happened to the United States, the UK, France, and so on after the Second World War, well, a whole bunch of things were introduced, partly because of the Great Depression, the so-called welfare state. Trade unions grew in their strength. Income inequality fell. So this was a period, the so-called golden age of capitalism was a period of greater equality. The capitalist system never did as well as it did during the golden age, which is the reason why we have that name, from the end of the Second World War until the 70s. So we know that taking steps towards a more equal society is not going to kill the economy. And we know also that there are a lot of economies in the world that are highly innovative, like, for example, Finland, the Nordic countries, South Korea. These are annually picked out by Bloomberg as the most innovative countries in the world. And what do we know about them? They're extremely equal compared to the United States. So we just have to get rid of the idea that taking a step in favor of fairness is going to cost us a heavy price. It could cost us a heavy price if we adopt poorly designed policies to achieve those goals. But there are policies which will do that. You mentioned the minimum wage. That helps. Other things would help as well. For example, restoring fair taxes on profits and the wealthy, and inheritance taxes and so on. There are plenty of ways to make America more equal. Again, it's not a big puzzle. We've seen it done in other countries who are doing better than us. We could do it too.
Yeah, and I would like to throw into that mix universal health care that does not come out of our monthly paycheck, but is part of how we're taxed.
That's an example of a broader set of policies that can really make a difference on the two dimensions. So if there's a universal health care, then that directly helps to reduce inequality, but it also helps to reduce the risks that families face. And if that's the case, then they're going to be much more likely to be in a position to set up an enterprise to actually try a new business idea that could, just like the examples that you were talking about early on about the plethora of small breweries, being able to take a risk of that kind depends on having some of the other risks in your life being taken care of. And it's this way of balancing the contribution that can be made by the state on the one side, the contribution that's made by the market, and how those can come together with a much greater engagement in enterprise at a community level. We can put those three things together in a much more productive combination than is the case at the moment. And that would deliver on both grounds, both a more innovative economy and a fairer one.
We have two parties in this country, two major parties, and it's not really clear to me that either one of them really represents ordinary Americans very effectively, or that either one of them is really listening to the kind of ideas that you guys are talking about. What can ordinary citizens do to improve our economic lives, not just our own, but the economy itself, really bringing it toward a more realistic and rational and human place?
Well, I'll start, and Wendy will have something to say, I'm sure. My perspective is that, of course, the parties differ in what they say and what they stand for, as should be the case. But it's crucial to understand that what happened in the 80s and 90s in the United States and in the UK was that both sides of the political aisle, the so-called left and right, Labour and Conservative in the UK, Democrats and Republicans in the United States, accepted the basic tenets of the neoliberal ideology. And they both went along with it. I mean, you think about in Labour, Blair, or among the Democrats, Clinton, that was part of their policy. Now, that being the case, it's not surprising that many Americans feel they're kind of left out. And this is not just a question of inequality. It's a question of communities, once proud industrial communities, now rusting, and people looking for work and feeling ashamed, not only of themselves, but of their neighbors and of the place they were once proud of. This is, of course, a kind of environment just looking for some answers, looking for a story. What happened? How can we fix it? Neither the Democrats nor the Republicans gave them an answer. Trump did supply an answer. It was a false answer, but it said basically, your problem is that somebody else got all the goods. And he made many people feel that this is really an us and them game. And the us looked to me kind of like white male America, or at least it was white America or white, and we should essentially then defend ourselves against the people who took our stuff away.
Who was them? Who was that?
Well, them could be, you know, the family from Somalia living down the road. I'm not sure how they really accounted for the fact that the factory had to close, but it could be them. Or it could be somebody challenging our way of life in Trump's terms and in the terms of many other people. When people are feeling that their lives have been destroyed unfairly, they're looking for an answer, and neither the Democrats nor the centrist Republicans gave them an answer. So it's not at all surprising. in the US that we got President Trump, and in the UK that they voted to leave the European Union.
I can't help but think that it is a kind of us and them. But the them isn't the Somali family down the street. The them is, in fact, Wall Street, which both parties are utterly dependent on to run their campaigns. But there are people who became fabulously wealthy at every step of this game and aren't sharing and don't want to share. And those are the them. I mean, those people are directly responsible, besides the competition. I mean, the automakers, you know, failing to compete with Japanese cars and so on. But when you think about what could be done about that and what kind of projects or new kinds of economies, Wall Street isn't interested. I mean, aren't they the them?
I wouldn't put it exactly that way, although I agree with you that if I had to choose the reason, the culprit in the plight of the American working class and other less well-off people in this country, it surely wouldn't be immigrants, and it wouldn't even be China. China trade has, of course, taken away many jobs in this country, but as you rightly said, mismanaged American automobile companies accounted for a lot of the problem, too. Now, a problem that we had in America, it may be the same in the UK, I'm not sure, is that during the 90s and into the current century, it was popular to go to the center and say, well, we want to have a nonpartisan solution. The problem in America is that we're disunified. That's the problem. And I wish I had heard somebody saying then, no, the problem is not that we're disunified. It's that the wrong people are running America. And they're running it into the ground. If somebody had said that, if instead of looking down the street, people had looked up to the 10th floor and said, what's going on there? And what decisions are they making? Maybe that would have been the basis for a political movement, which would have ended the neoliberal bad dream a lot earlier.
The 10th floor of?
The people at the top of the corporation, the ones running the show.
Right. You have both come up with a curriculum for teaching economics in a new way called Core Econ. It's on the web at core-econ.org. People can take it and sign up for free, I think, right?
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about that and what your hopes are for this curriculum.
The move to try to develop a new way of teaching economics really came out of two threads. One of them was the crisis of 2008-09. The finger was pointed at economists. Why were we not made aware that there was this building instability in the financial system, the role of Wall Street, as you've highlighted? So that was one really wake-up call to economists and to think about what we were doing in our classrooms. The kids in the classroom were really embarrassed. They were going home at Christmas. Their parents were asking them, well, you know, we're in the middle of this crisis. You're studying economics. Tell me what's going on. And the students would say, well, actually, I can't tell you anything. I'm not learning anything about that. I'm learning about supply and demand. And that was a source of real anger among students. And there was another completely different thread which came from Chile and from the strikes in secondary schools there, which were a response to the privatization of education. The students from the university there went out to the schools, joined the high school students, and then they went back to their classrooms at university and said, well, why aren't we learning about inequality? Why aren't we learning about the effects of the economic policies in Chile? And the result was that we pulled together a group of economists from all around the world and sat down with a blank piece of paper and thought, well, given all the tremendous new research that's been done in economics over the last couple of decades, can't we bring that to bear in the classroom? Isn't that the kind of economics that will help students understand the problems that are really on their mind? And one thing we've done is we've gone into classrooms all around the world. We've posed a question to students. We've said, what's the most pressing problem economists should be tackling? And overwhelmingly, the result comes back, inequality. It's inequality, environmental sustainability, it's the future of work, financial instability. None of these questions were being tackled in their classrooms. And that was this yawning gap that we've sought to fill. And we've managed over the last few years to create an interactive ebook. It's very engaging. It's free, accessible to anyone. You can have the app on your phone so you can play around with it. And this is now being used in classrooms in many different universities across the world, in London, in Paris. We had a recent report from Kabul in Afghanistan.
Wow. Well, much more to talk about, but it is time to go. Wendy Carlin is a professor of economics at University College London. Sam Bowles is an economist and a research professor at the Santa Fe Institute. They will be speaking on Tuesday, July 17th at 7:30 at the Lenzic Performing Arts Center here in Santa Fe. And for more information, you can go to santafe.edu and also lenzic.org. And I will put on my website, radiocafe.org, links to their work and to the core econ curriculum. Thank you both so much for being with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. This program is brought to you in part by Dotfoil Computer Services, providing computer repair and business services for Apple and PC. They're Santa Fe's only Apple-authorized service provider. You can find them on the web at dotfoil.com and in the Candyman Center in Santa Fe. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.